Would you please join me in welcoming our speaker tonight, Scott from the Back Room Group in Nashville, Tennessee.
Good evening. My name is Scott Lee, and I am alcoholic and honored to be here. It's a big deal for me to attend an AA group. I owe a debt I can't repay, and I know the people here that understand that. I'm quite moved, and I love the way you open this meeting. It's going to take me a minute. I'm not a professional speaker. I'm a puking drunk from down south. That's the truth. I really love the 30-day thing. I wonder if there are members of Al-Anon here. Can I see hands if there are any? Let's see, one, two, three, four. Thank you for coming. I am so honored by your presence. I couldn't live the spectacular life I live if my beloved Miss Linda didn't have a fabulous Al-Anon program. So I really salute you. And I like to open anything I do with a quotation from your co-founder, Lois, who was asked one time what she did in the moment of silence before the Serenity Prayer, and she said, "I invite God to the meeting." That was powerful for me, and I started doing it, and meetings get better everywhere. And in a moment, I'm going to ask for a moment of silence. I'm going to ask all of you, if you would, to literally invite your God to come. My great teacher was a fellow named Don from Denver. Some of you probably heard him, and he used to say that he tried to treat God like a gentleman. Gentlemen don't go where they're not invited. They don't stay where they're not made welcome. And so that's what I'm going to ask us to honor. And just in case you don't have a God or you got one you're afraid of or something that's not working for you, borrow mine for this time tonight. You can address him as the God of Scott's limited understanding. Get you off on the right foot. We're not asking you to lie to him. And try for an experiment. Just see what happens. The other thing I do in the moment of silence is I ask God to help me not judge any of the speakers. Now, you don't have to do that. But meetings have gotten dramatically better for me since I started doing that. So if you would, literally, let's take a couple of moments and actually invite God to join us and bless us with open hearts. I'll just meet you back here. Amen. Thank you. And I feel better. That helped. I was asked, by the way, to tell my story tonight, and I found the direction, strangely enough, in the big book. In a couple of places, I'm going to read one of my favorites from page 50. It says, "In our personal stories, you will find a wide variation in the way each teller approaches and conceives of the power which is greater than himself." So that apparently is my subject. I will tell you, I did not begin my life on a mission to develop a relationship with God. I began my life a victim of the delusion that I could wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if only I managed well. Sound familiar? That's on page 61. Sound familiar? I like to quote the noted American philosopher Alfred E. Newman, who once said, "Most people don't know what they want, but they're pretty sure they haven't got it." And that's my story, and I didn't fly in from Nashville, Tennessee to talk to you tonight. I come to talk with you. I hope you'll play with me. It'll be more fun for everybody. But just a couple of examples here. Who, when you were a kid, wanted a bicycle? You were certain if you could get a bicycle, you'd be happy, and you got a bike. Anybody? Come on. Okay, thanks. Are you happy? No? Well, that didn't work. Let's try another one. Who wanted him or her? Sure, if you get him, you'd be happy, and you got him. Okay, now, you could be sitting next to him, so I'm going to do you a favor. I don't ask the other question. Because I'm trying to be nice. Made a good. Who was sure if you could get rid of him or her, you'd be happy? Come on. Come on. I got to look at the truth. And the truth is, getting what I want isn't going to make me happy. It never did. Never did. I know it's not supposed to be a book study, but I love this book. This is page 42. It says, "It meant I would have to throw several lifelong conceptions out of the window. One is one, a couple is two, several is more than two." Lifelong conceptions out of the window. What that says in plain old Tennessee English is, some of what I know for sure ain't so. And although I do have a problem with what I don't know, my bigger problem, I think, is what I know for certain that's actually wrong. And what was necessary for me to do is to release my grip on what I know for sure. When I got here suffering from what I like to call the John Wayne syndrome. See if you recognize it. At about age 11, I get a mental image of what a man is, and I pretend to be that for the next 30 years. Big boys don't cry. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. When the going gets tough, the tough gets going. Never let them see your weakness. Never ask a stupid question. Get what you want. It'll make you happy. Never give up. Never surrender, no matter what. Sound familiar to anybody? Yeah. Most of us get here doing that. And it turns out that every bit of that is exactly wrong. Perfectly, exactly wrong. Real men are not afraid of their emotions. They're not afraid to ask questions that someone may think stupid. That's how they learn. I mean, it's just all of that was exactly wrong. And I'm just, anyway, let's start drinking. Let's talk about drinking. I didn't mean that. I didn't start drinking until I was 18 years old. Today sponsors 6 men that got sober before they were 18 years old. And I just don't think they had sufficient willpower. They couldn't hang in as long as I did. I'm not ashamed of them. I try not to embarrass them for it, but clearly thin on willpower. And went away to college. I'm going through fraternity rush. I get out with fraternity boys. They start drinking beer. I start drinking beer. If they'd been going down to burn down one of the dormitories, I'd have gone with them, right? Because whatever they were doing, I would have done because I wanted to be one of them. And so I start drinking beer. I don't like the taste. I don't like the way the bubbles feel going down. I don't like anything about it except I'm doing it with them. That I like. And by the time the second one hit bottom, I got magic. All the alcoholics know what I'm talking about. And the earthlings never do quite get that. They don't understand that. And I just got taller. Who got taller? Come on, play with me. Who got taller? How about better looking? You can leave them up. Right? My pimples fell right off. I expect it every year. I expect to see it on the Super Bowl ads. Bud Light cures acne. I did figure, have you seen this new ad on Budweiser Select? Have you seen this one? One of the things I say about it is it finishes clean. I know what that means. It means when you puke, you don't even have to wipe. You know, just put it... Just put it right where you want it. You don't even have to do this anymore. That's what finishes clean means. Anyway, figured it out all by myself. Let's see. So I'm taller and better looking. Oh, and I got lubricated lips. All of a sudden I can talk to the girls. Right, guys? Yeah. And fantastic dancer. Dancers? Come on. Where are you, dancers? Okay. How about this one? Get ready for this one. Expert on many subjects. That's some experts? We have experts? Yes, a whole family of experts over here in the second row. Father-daughter team, unbelievable. And any one of those would have been enough to take me back to doing it again. And I haven't even gotten to the big one yet. Because the biggest one was for the first time in my life, something inside me went, whew, and it was just okay. It was just okay, and it never had been before. Up until that very moment, I think I might have been willing to trade lives with anybody because mine wasn't working. And I don't know how it happened. Sometime when I was a very small boy, I somehow became convinced that I'm insufficient. I'm one of the defective ones. There's things that are wrong with me that can't be fixed or even worked on. And I became an actor, a chameleon, as a very small boy, pretending to be the guy that I think you want me to be. And you is defined as whoever's in front of me right this second. The end of my drinking, I got a customer at one end of my territory. It's a very religious guy. He knows a very religious Scott. Got a customer 40 miles from there that's a Friday night party guy. He knows a Friday night party Scott. I got the boys in the pool room where I buy my dope and drink my beer, and they know that Scott. And I got family members. I got business partners. I got neighbors. Everybody knows a different Scott. And the greatest fear in my life is people from different segments of my life be at the same place, same time. How am I going to act? Right? Because I am acting all the time. By the time I get to you, I've been acting so long, I have no idea who I am. I do not know who stands behind the last mask. All I know, my core truth is I'm not good enough. And see, I was wrong about that too. God Almighty was not having a bad day in the middle of a long losing streak when he came up with me or any of you. It didn't happen that way. See, I was just wrong. But anyway, that second beer hit bottom, and I was suddenly tall enough, smart enough, good looking enough, I could talk to the girls, expert on many subjects, fantastic dancer. And all of a sudden, it was just okay to be me. It was just okay. To sort of fast forward, I zipped through a 4-year college and 5 years of 2 summer schools. Come on, I know you're here. These are my people. And I joined the United States Air Force, and I was sent to Valdosta, Georgia, where I speak the language. And Air Force pilot training, in the last 6 months of training, we flew the T-38, which you're all familiar with. You may not know that you are, but you are. You saw Top Gun, didn't you? Saw the movie? They had the dogfight with the MiGs. Did you think the Russians loaned Hollywood MiGs? Sorry. And that airplane was then and is today the Air Force's advanced jet trainer. The single-seat version is the F-5. It's an interceptor that some of the NATO countries are still using as a first-line interceptor. It's a high-performance plane. Those words mean afterburning jet engines faster than the speed of sound. That's what the words mean. This airplane is a Mach 1.5 airplane. It's stressed for about 7.5 positive Gs, and as I recall, around 4 negative Gs. And I'll give you sort of a feel for what this thing does. It has a roll rate of 720 degrees a second. Yeah, your eyeballs won't track that if you're sober. I mean, it's just a blur. It's a pretty blur, but it's a blur. And a loop is defined as a 360-degree turn through the vertical plane, pulling positive Gs. You enter a loop in this plane at 10,000 feet at 500 knots. That's about 550 miles an hour. And you pull up at 5 Gs. I'll tell you what that means. You're pulling 1 G right now. It's the force of gravity. At 1 G, a 200-pound man weighs 200 pounds. At 5 Gs, a 200-pound man weighs 1,000 pounds. That is precisely what that means. Everything on you now weighs times 5. That, by the way, includes your upper eyelids. And you may not be aware of them now, but at 5 Gs you will be as you struggle to keep them open. And so here we are at 10,000 feet, 500 knots, 5 Gs. We're wings level inverted at 20. It takes 10 to pull her over on her back. And we lose 8,000 feet coming down the backside of that maneuver. Total elapsed time under 25 seconds. And I tell you all about the airplane for two reasons. The first, of course, is to impress you. Anybody? I'm up on that. We've got to get one of those. And got to get one of those. And the other reason I tell you is because I think it'll help you understand my alcoholism very easily. We're finished for the day at about 5:30 in the afternoon. I head over to the officers' club. Now, I don't plan to get drunk this particular evening. Used to get drunk on purpose frequently. That's why I'm going out tonight. But I also used to get drunk by accident. Were you ever accidentally drunk? You know, where you didn't really mean to be? Like, maybe the guy in the next bar stool was contagious and I caught it from him. Something like that. You know what I'm talking about? Okay, that would happen to me. I have tomorrow morning at 7:30 a flight in that airplane. We're going to be doing acrobatics in a have you ever seen the Thunderbirds? They flew this thing for 7 years. We're going to do a lot of what they did tomorrow morning at 7:30. I'm going to be in close trail, about 4.5 feet away from another plane. His afterburner's right there. And we're going to be pulling 5 to 7.5 Gs going over the top. Guys like me doze off on roller coasters. We find them boring, all right? And I'm going to be doing this for an hour and a half at a time. No one with a brain would get drunk the night before going to do that. Can you see that? Okay. We're going to do audience participation. I expect you to fill in the blanks. I'll give you your cues. Are you ready? Okay. 5:30 in the afternoon. Don't plan to get drunk tonight. Have to be crazy to get drunk tonight before going to fly high-performance acrobatics. But I do want to socialize the other pilots of my squadron. I think I'll drop by the club and have one beer, no more than 2. Come on. I noticed you Al-Anons didn't play. Now pay attention. This is what you heard on the phone. Isn't this what they heard on the phone? And you believed it again. That's why you have to come to Al-Anon. The ones that ran screaming from guys like me don't have to come to your thing, do they? No, they don't. So together now, going to have one beer, no more than? I should be home by 6:30, no later than? It's good to have a plan.
But what happens is by the time the second drink hits bottom, I develop what Dr. Silkworth calls in the text this phenomenon of craving. What I think happens is I change my mind. But what really happens, I get this craving and I have one more. And I don't leave the club in time to get home by 7. Actually, I leave the officer's club at exactly 1 o'clock in the morning because they... Vaughn, this is one of the biggest groups of pilots I've ever talked to. And drive home drunk with a hand over one eye. Come on, where are you? You bet. Okay. And walk in the house, my first wife tears into me. A lot of information in that sentence. Play it back. And I head into the bathroom for what I call my after drinking chores. All right, pukers. Come on. Come on, get them up, come on, put them up. Pukers. How about nose pukers? Ever come out your nose even once? Come on, put them up. One of the things that you'll notice about your nose pukers is they tend to quit forever when they're puking out their nose. Is that right or is that wrong? That's right. Doggone right, that's right. Who quit forever solemn oath on the Bible in front of witnesses at least once? Come on. Whoa, all right. These are my people. Yeah. Who peed in the closet? Did you really? I never did that. I'm so embarrassed for you. That's awful. I don't believe I'd have admitted that in public. You know, there's a big difference between a fifth step and sharing in a meeting. You might want to check with your sponsor on that. I never did that. Although I will admit that my first wife is still angry about that antique coffee table that used to be in the living room. I'll give you that. Who regularly takes meetings into jails and prisons? Get them up and keep them up, please. Get them up real high. Everybody else get a look at them. If you're suffering from depression, get with one of these people and take one meeting into the jail. It will break your depression. You know, thank you. There's a huge difference between being clinically depressed and being spiritually depressed. Don't take the treatment for being clinically depressed until you've tried the one for spiritually. They look a lot alike. All right? Don't let me hurt anybody's feelings on that. But try our prescription before you try somebody else's. That's all I'm asking. And the reason I thought about that then is I had a meeting in Depod in the county lockup one night, about 25 guys sitting around, and I went through that little routine you just heard, and I ad-libbed the thing about who peed in the closet, and one poor fool put his hand up. And they don't laugh much in the jail. But I worked him over, and they did that night. And when the laughter finally died down, the old boy said, "Hey, man, no big deal. It wasn't my closet." It's a perspective thing. And I thought the two most important and creative inventions of the 20th century, both invented by alcoholics, by the way, one was that little half moon of carpet they put around the commode for you to kneel on. That was invented by one of our guys. You know, his knees were all torn up from that hard bathroom floor. He says, "We ought to put..." And that soft commode seat you could rest your head on, kind of in between there, you know. It's not as cold as the porcelain, but it's softer. And so I'm in there puking up my toenails, quitting forever, right? Quitting forever. And I would pray. This is not in the literature. I'm just playing, but see if it fits. And I would pray what I call there are actually three pre-AA prayers in my experience. One is, "God, help me pass this test I didn't study for." The second one is, "Please don't let her be pregnant." And I'm told it can be prayed in the first person singular. And we're going to do the third one together. I'm going to do the first line. You're going to do the second, okay? So I'm in the bathroom on the prayer rug. And I'm puking up my toenails. And I pray the pre-AA prayer. I do the first line, you do the second. "God, get me out of this." Which is alcoholic for amen. Isn't that right? That's right. I brush my teeth and go to bed. It's got to be 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning. I get up at 6. I'm not even hungover yet. Remember that Wonderland in between those? Oh, I miss that so much, don't you? And here we are at 7:30 in the morning. Listen, I'm wearing a G-suit and a parachute. I'm sitting on a 20-millimeter cannon shell. This is an ejection seat. This is a real high-performance plane. And I'm dying, though. I'm dying. You remember The Hangover? You remember the one where the butcher knife went in just above your right eye and came out the back? Remember that one? And the eyelids are made out of sandpaper. The throat and nasal passages are raw. Yeah. I got a trimmer in my hands. I've selected 100% on the oxygen lever. It won't cure a hangover. I tried it hundreds of times, and I've talked to Sandy and Lyle, a bunch of other pilots, and I'll tell you, it won't cure a hangover. And I'm also, by the way, tight on the leader flying the mission. And what I just described to you really is willpower. We got it. It's no defense against our disease, but we got willpower. And I got a friend says that he thinks that's the reason that so many non-alcoholics don't become alcoholics, is they ain't got the willpower for it. You know, the guy goes out on prom night, he drinks a pint and a half of Jack Daniels, he pukes on his date's dress, he wrecks his truck, he wakes up in the drunk tank, he says, I'm never doing that again. And he never does. It's an obvious lack of willpower, I think. I'm only 22 years old and my body is resilient. I'm eating saltines and drinking milk all day. By 5:30 that afternoon, I'm not well. I'm maybe 85, 90%. I'll tell you one thing I know for sure, I ain't getting drunk tonight. We got a four-ship tomorrow morning doing acrobatics. Four of us, not two. Nobody with a brain to get drunk tonight before going to do that. But I do want to drop by the club and socialize with the other pilots of my squadron. I think I'll have one beer, no more than. She'll be home by 6:30, no later than. But I leave the club at 1 because I drive home drunk and I listen to her and puke my guts out and God get me out of this. There's some amen. Yeah. All right for the amen. That was a fine amen. Yeah. Anybody here have been proud of that one? See me later. I'd like to have your autograph. And I'm doing that over and over again. And I'm sitting in that cockpit the next day, bleary eyed, dying. And I can't look into the past all the way to yesterday. And say, weren't you dying of a hangover yesterday when we lit burners and every day last week and every day last month? And I was powerless over alcohol and I was ignorant of the fact that I was powerless over alcohol. And that's a tough combination, ignorance and powerlessness. I had the gift. I know guys that can hit a golf ball 300 yards. I can drive a plane. I just had the gift. I did well. As an active alcoholic, I flew for 5 years. I disrespected the thing I love the most. My earliest memories as a child are sitting up in a tree flying it. I always wanted to fly. And at one point during Vietnam, I was flying a very highly classified mission, and I was so drunk taxiing my plane out that I taxied it off into the weeds. If it had been daylight instead of dark, if there had been a rock out there, a stump, a ditch, a cliff, if there had been a plane taxiing behind mine, somebody else would be with you, fine folk, tonight, and I'd still be in a military prison. Because I wasn't that .10 DUI social drinker drunk. I'm talking about what we would consider to be drunk. And I'm not proud of that. I think that's what alcoholism does to nice folks like us. It has us disrespect the things that we love the most, harm the people that we love the most. That's what it does to us. We don't mean to do that. I didn't mean to do that. I resigned my commission. I have an honorable discharge. I was marked for high rank. They were giving me very high ratings. And I just walked away. I got a job as a sales rep. I joined a manufacturer's rep agency. I became a junior partner. And in late June of 1984, the senior partner came to me one day and he said, you're going to treatment right now or you're fired. He was a great communicator. He could like explain it so you would really understand. You see how someone like that might become a senior partner. And June 28, 1984, which was my 41st birthday, happy birthday to you, I signed into a little charm school outside of Atlanta, Georgia, called Ridgeview. And they told me later I was probably the saddest person they'd ever seen come through the door. And I'll tell you what, I was sad. When they told me I couldn't do the things I'd been doing, I never thought I was going to have any more fun. I thought the party was over. That was one of those things I was just plain dead wrong about. I had not had any fun yet, and I didn't know it. I was just wrong. I didn't sleep the first 3 nights I was in treatment. And I'm laying there the fourth night knowing I'm not going to sleep again. And some of you may recall, you ain't drinking, you ain't sleeping. Psh, boy, it stays dark a long time. And man, it goes on and on. And I'm laying there this fourth night, and what I'm about to tell you happened to me. It's not like I did it. But I saw my life, as you might see, a series of very short movies, and mostly the significant events, but a lot of other stuff too. And I've always given myself credit for my intentions. I'm probably the best intended person you're ever going to meet. My favorite one, I used to do close-up magic. And one of these days I was going to get a clown suit. When I was on the road, instead of running the bars and chasing the dollies, I'm going to put on the clown suit and take my magic kit into a children's hospital to do a show for the kids. Everybody here would say it'd take a pretty great guy. I haven't done it yet, by the way. But take a really spectacular guy to do something like that, you know, in one of these days. And our third step talks about a decision. For me, the difference between an intention and a decision, an intention is followed by more intentions. A decision is followed by action. That's the difference. And this night, as I lay there in that bed in that treatment center, and I see my life, I don't see the intentions, only the actions. It's not a pretty story. And I got to the place where I began to think about the single worst thing I'd ever done. I got one stands alone. I'd always been able to stop that. Three double jacks will knock that out. A couple of shots of tequila, six pack. I know how to turn that off. Not laying in a bunk in a treatment center, I don't. And it's like lights out at 11. I got to stay in that bunk until 6 the next morning. I mean, short potty breaks, but that's it. I'm stuck. And I got me all over me. And I can't get me off of me. And I can't get it stopped. We use the term bottom in our fellowship, and I haven't seen the definition in our literature, and I'll tell you my experience with it. I have met in my tours into the prisons men who are serving long prison sentences due to drinking, that are planning to drink when they get out. They are not at bottom. I have puked blood on occasions. That was not bottom. I've been in plenty of kinds of trouble. Not bottom. Bottom for me was in here. Bottom was when I hated my guts and so repulsed by the things I'd done. I'd have paid any price and done anything for relief from that guilt. That's just as close as I can come to describing it to you. But at the point where I reached that, this is what happened. What I'm about to tell you did not happen in my head at all. It did not come out of my mouth, and it didn't happen in my throat. This part of me screamed to a God that I don't think I believed in, God, forgive me. Like that, but from in here. And I'm lying on my back in this bed, and all of this happened at once. Suddenly, there was this magnificent light, and it was just shining on me. And the light had a warmth and a texture. And with my eyes closed, I could see that room in better detail than I can see this one tonight. There was a physical sensation that I describe as being like when you're in the dentist office and they finish taking the x-rays of your teeth. They pull that protective apron, that heavy thing off of you. There was something heavy apparently laying on me that I was unaware of that flew off of me very fast, all at the same instant. And my body felt so light I thought it was going to float off the bed. And I knew in that moment that there was a God, that God had the power to forgive me, and I was forgiven. And I used to say God forgave me, but I don't speak for God, and I'm not comfortable around people that do. I don't know that he forgave me then. I know that I received the forgiveness then. I'm not sure that he ever judged me. I don't know. But I know that I received the forgiveness then. And I lay there in the presence of infinite love, and it felt so good it almost hurt. There was, I don't usually tell this, but also behind me, very close to me, I'm lying on my back, behind me was a white partition that went from the floor up almost to the ceiling and the width of the room. And in it there were different colors and shapes of glass. And this light was coming through the glass, and they were spread out kind of far. And it was also coming over the top. And this light felt so good that it almost hurt. And I can't explain that either, but I can report it. And I lay there in the presence of infinite love, and I can't tell you how long. I can't tell you it was 2 seconds or 3 hours, because those things are the same in that presence, because what we call time does not exist in that presence. And I can't explain that, but I know it's true. And I lay there with him for a while. I don't know of anything else that passed between us except my receipt of forgiveness. And after that, I must have slept, because I awakened the next morning, and I had not done that in several days. And I awakened wanting to be one of his guys, and that was my first cornerstone. I've talked to a number of people who feel like they've been robbed because they didn't get one of those. This is Bill's story, page 12. But the sense of his presence had been blotted out by worldly clamors, mostly those of them myself. I do not believe that that event alone would have kept me sober 24 and a half years. I don't believe it. It was a cornerstone for a last gasper like me. I think I was near death and no one knew it. And a couple of weeks later, I was called into my counselor's office. Although he was a member of Al-Anon, I'd like to salute you again. I really mean it. This man saved my life. And I was called in. We were going to work on my aftercare plan. I knew that was the mission. And I went in there with a great attitude to try to help this guy put this thing together. Okay, if you're new and didn't laugh, please try to get everything else to shut off for the next 2 minutes. I could save your life with this, okay? And I came through the door and I explained to him, I'm not taking antabuse. If you don't know, it's a pill. If they prescribe me to take it and drink, it makes you very sick. I'm not taking antabuse. I'm not going to halfway house. It's a 28-day program. I'm not staying a minute longer. And I just did that to lay out the parameters for the nice man to help him do his work. I was just being helpful. And he said, you've left out something you aren't going to do. I said, what? He said, you're not going to make it. Well, I'm not a violent man by nature, but I make an occasional exception. Made one for him. And fortunately enough, it was verbal. And part of my recovery has been cleaning up my language. I don't know about you, but I can't hear a spiritual message through a barrage of sewage. And so I can't quote myself. But what I said was, generally, why'd you say that? I didn't even know his family. And and he responded with a question that saved my life. I said, why'd you say that? And he said, if you already know how to run a program to keep yourself sober, how is it you happen to be a patient here? And I responded by very cleverly saying, nothing came out. And I'd never had that experience before. I could always answer. You could always answer. You had to make some of it up, but you could say something. I can't say anything. He got me. My goodness, the unanswerable question. That event took about as long to happen as it just took me to tell it. I know that's a 1-hour meeting. I know I stayed the whole time. I heard nothing else as my mind locks onto the unanswerable question. And from there, I went to lunch and the movie and group and phys ed. Wherever I was supposed to be, my body's there. My mind is back in Jim's office trying to answer the unanswerable question. About 9 o'clock that night, I'm walking back across the campus to my cottage. And it's like the answer was flying through the air and hit me in the chest. And I swear to you, this part of me knew the answer before this part knew. And the answer was and is, I don't know how to run a program to keep myself sober. If I'm going to be one of the few who make it, excuse me, I'm going to have to do it all. This is not a cafeteria lunch for a guy like me where I can take what I want and leave the rest because I have to win now. I've got to win this time. I cannot afford to not win this time. There's nothing in my life that matters to me that is not suspended from my recovery. Here's my recovery. Here's what hangs from it. My life. Do you think a drunken pilot with a couple of thousand hours could have been killed? Not to mention driving drunk, some of that other stuff. My sanity. Been to the insane asylum. I've been in the little rubber room in my underwear with no doorknob on my side. Been there. My freedom should be serving life in a military prison. That's a few of the things that are wagered. My relationship with this fabulous woman that I'm married to and our children and grandchildren. My job, my house, my car, my peace of mind. There's nothing in my life that matters to me that isn't hanging from my recovery. Because if I lose that recovery, everything else hits the floor and shatters. I don't know what your situation is. That's mine tonight. That's why I'm here. That's why I'm here. I don't care what the price is. I will be happy to pay it. Because I get the rest of my life if I keep this first. It was at that point that I embraced what I today lovingly call Step 1, Section B. Aha! Yeah. I thought it said, powerless over alcohol, therefore our lives have become unmanageable. On close examination, I've discovered the word therefore does not appear in step one. Looked up punctuation in the dictionary. You'll never believe this. But a hyphen is not shorthand for therefore. I couldn't believe it. What it does is connect two unrelated thoughts. The reason I was confused is on June 27, 1984, day of my most recent drink, the fact on that day that I was powerless over alcohol and my life was crashing down around my ears were related. On the 21st of February, 2009, I am powerless over alcohol. My life is unmanageable by me. I'm not playing with you. It's one of the most powerful concepts I've ever come across. I have actually read the text a number of times. I can't find a page in the book that says congratulations. Having achieved this lofty spiritual level, your life is now manageable. The tank's full. The keys are in it. Load up. Get them. Somebody shout out the page number. I can't find it either. I find where it promises me sanity a couple of places. And part of my sanity is I don't want what I want anymore. I was getting what I wanted when I qualified to come to sit with you nice people. There's serious doubt as to how much more I could survive of what I want. I want what God wants me to have. I don't know what it is. I know how to get it. It's by doing these things you've taught me in the magic word of courses today. See, I have fired me as general manager of my own life based on my performance. Good manager would have fired me several decades ago. And one of the first things I did when I awakened this morning was I invited God in to run my life. Not give me some help, but run it. And whatever he has in mind suits me fine. Miss Linda says it this way. It's a concept I would have gotten it on my own. God's will, it's a good deal. Who'd have thunk it? That wasn't what I would have expected. Anyway, I zipped through the 28-day treatment program in 6 weeks flat. And I've always been a quick study. And I get back to Nashville. And I started doing the aftercare plan. They said go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And I went to 87. And there were I can't remember two of them. There was one night I was about to leave for the meeting. And my son fell and hurt himself rather badly. We went to the emergency room instead of the meeting. That's the right thing. And I thought if you missed, you just missed. I didn't know you could go to two meetings in a day. Because I got a terminal case of newcomer thinking, going to kill me soon if I don't get help with it. And they said, stay away from your old playmates and playgrounds. My favorite bar in Nashville is on 8th Avenue South. I was sober over 2 years the next time my vehicle turned onto 8th Avenue South. I didn't go on the street for over 2 years. I'm not kidding you. I completed, I have to really watch my language here, some very well-meaning people have taken the steps off of the wall and tried to add some psycho stuff to it to try to help people. I think they're committing murder. But I completed one of these psychobabble fill-in-the-blanks multiple choice alleged four steps. I think the second best secret kept secret in our fellowship is that the fourth step is cleverly concealed in the big book. They actually tell you how to do it in here. Who'd have thunk it? And but anyway, I completed this fill-in-the-blanks multiple choice. I mean, one of the questions, do you still hate your mother? Please. And I called back down to the treatment center to Bernie. Now, Bernie had not been my counselor, but the reason that I asked him to hear my fifth step is because you could look at him and tell he was stoned out of his mind. I thought, I'm taking my fifth step with this junkie. Well, you know what it looks like when somebody's stoned, his face is real relaxed, he got this dumb grin, when he moves, he kind of shuffles along. I said, yeah, he's a perfect choice. You know, 3 weeks later, will he know what I said? He won't be sure if we did it. So I thought he was a good choice. So I called, he said, sure, I drove down, and I took my fifth step with him, which is where I began to get relief. And boy, I'll tell you what, if you're new here and the steps look like they're designed to punish you, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how they look to us, too, and we were wrong about that, and you are also. And I don't care. You're wrong. And because that's where I began to get the relief. And I think that's what the steps do. I think if I'd been doing the actual steps, that'd be out of the book, with an actual sponsor, that'd be one who's already done the steps out of the book, I would have been getting relief long before then. And just sort of as an aside, Bernie was not stoned. Bernie was sober over 20 years. That was serenity. I didn't know what it looked like. Newcomer thinking, terminal case, going to die from it soon. And at about 5 months, the only thing I hadn't done on the aftercare list was get a sponsor. Okay, if you're sober less than a year, don't try this, you won't get it. Everybody else, two-word fill in the blank. I am so insane that I'm looking for a sponsor I can relate to. Yeah, is that not the craziest thing you ever heard in your life? Holy cow! Wow! I can't figure out you can go to two meetings in one day. Who can I relate to? I can relate to the squirrel on the next branch that didn't know his left ear from straight up is who I can relate to. Thank God I didn't find a sponsor I could relate to. We'd both be dead by now. God save me from a sponsor I can relate to. Oh, no, not that. What I needed was a sponsor I would obey. New concept. Not to run my life, but to run my recovery program. And this guy was in a meeting and his lights were on. You know what I mean by that? I wanted to feel like this guy looked. I said, would you sponsor me? He said, well, we'll see. Here's your first assignment. assignment. I thought a sponsor was like a new best friend. Okay, show you around, you know, take you to some other meetings, loan you some money, fix your wife, that sort of thing. Wrong about that. And it took me a week. I don't have the time. I'm not ashamed of it. Ask me later. I'll be glad to tell you. It took me a week, and I came back and said, okay, Jerry, I did the assignment. He said, I'll sponsor you my way. I said, what does that mean exactly? And he said, you are too sick to stay sober on the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You will need the program also. And I got no idea what he means. And Jerry said, the single best kept secret in Alcoholics Anonymous is the definition of the program. How do we keep it secret? Well, we read it at just almost every meeting. It's in the most read, least listened to portion of our literature. On page 60, immediately before step one, where it says, here are the steps we took, which is suggested as a... No steps, no program. I'm going to be real direct for a minute, and it's because I've been to too many funerals. We're committing murder with the phrase, and the phrase is don't drink and go to meetings. You'll die from that. Jerry said if sitting with a bunch of other alcoholics talking about our problems is going to get people sober, the boys under the Woodland Street Bridge would be sober tonight. That's who they are. That's what they're doing. It doesn't work for them, and it won't work for us. The meetings are good. They're really good. The program is the 12 steps. I have personally, in 24 years, not seen anyone who's been in and out of the program. I hear the phrase, it makes me sick. In and out of the fellowship is what I'm seeing. I see that a lot. I have not at this point seen anyone take the steps out of this book while being sponsored and coached by someone who's already taken the steps out of this book and stay active and drink again. Has anyone seen that? Is there 400 in here tonight? I would, and y'all been putting your hands up all night. I would say that we as a group tonight stand by the first line in chapter 5. Rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path. Forward to the third edition says our path is the 12 steps. It's that simple. This isn't some get it and some don't. This is some do it and some don't. This is not about what I can learn. It's about what I must do. And he said, you're going to do the 12 steps the way I lay them out at the pace I set, or I'm going to drop you like a bad habit because I don't work with losers. And he scared me so bad I was honest with him. You know what I mean? I don't spread the truth around real thick. And save it for emergencies. And I said, Jerry, I don't want to do the 12 steps. And he said, that's okay. I said, good. He said, long as you do them. Jerry, I don't think we're communicating. Yeah, we are. You've been hearing the word willingness? Yeah. Well, there's the definition. Willingness is when I do what my sponsor says, whether I want to or not. He says, you ever try to get sober on your own? Yeah. How many times? I don't know. How many times? I don't know. Give me a number. Oh, Jerry, about 2,000. I'm a puker. He said, that was doing what you wanted to do and not doing what you didn't want to do. I said, well, yeah. He said, that didn't work. So it must be to get sober, you're going to have to do some things you'd rather not do and not do some things you kind of like to do. He was becoming difficult to argue with. So I hit him with my Sunday punch. I said, why do I have to do the 12 steps? Let me tell you a secret about why. When I ask why, I am not looking for an answer. I'm looking for something I can argue with. Right? Yeah. And he said, I don't answer why questions for the men I sponsor. Step 1, Section B says, you're not in management. Why is a management question? Consequently, all the answers to the why questions are the same. And the answers are, you don't need to know. And I hated that when he said it. And today I embrace it as one of the great truths, and I love it. Because I always thought it was not knowing that made me crazy. Incorrect. It was needing to know that was making me crazy. Wow. And when I laid down the need to know, I became peaceful. And at that point, I began to know. Can't explain that either. And... But he says, I'm going to give you one why question lifetime. Don't ever ask another one. And I have not. And he said, I'm going to tell you why you have to do the 12 steps. He said, it's because alcohol's not your problem. What? Alcohol's not your problem. It's your answer. It's what makes you tall enough, smart enough, good looking enough. You can talk to the girls, fantastic dancer, expert on many subjects. This is for you as the lubricant of life. This is the only thing that's ever made your skin fit. And when we say to a guy like you, lay down the booze, we haven't said put down your problem. We've said put down the only answer you have ever known. And when you do that, it leaves you without an answer. And you are the kind of guy who needs an answer, or you would have never been an alcoholic. And every time he took a breath, I said, why? Because I was losing fast here. And he said, think of yourself as a garbage can. Got that one. He says, what we will do with these 12 steps is we're going to dump you out. We're going to scrub the can and stand it back up. We're going through your life. Most of it's trash. We're tossing it. Portions are good. We'll keep them. For example, you love your kids? I said, yeah, a lot. He said, great. We'll keep that. When we get finished with these 12 steps, you'll be a big, empty, clean can, just a little good stuff in the bottom. He said, our program's a little bit about going to the dentist. We're going to have to drill before we can fill. We got to dig that poison out of your soul, because if we just fill with the good stuff, the poison's still in there. It'll detonate one of these days. Like the dentist, we got Novocaine. Here we call it fellowship, home group, sponsorship, love. It's not that hard. It's not near as hard as the way you've been living. And he said, the reason you got to have that empty, clean space, a little good stuff in the bottom. He says, one of these days, something very heavy is going to slam into your heart. He said, your father's going to die. And on that day, if you don't have that empty, clean space to store that pain in, while we love you back to spiritual health, you will escape. And the only escapes you know are killing you and devastating everyone around you. And I ran out of why. And I allowed the man to coach me through the 12 steps. And I got what for me is the most powerful promise in our text. It's the first line on page 60. It says 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. It doesn't say a result. You hear it read that way. It's not what it says. The is singular. They promised me a spiritual awakening. I used to quit forever all the time. Right? Forever is somewhere between 20 minutes and about 2 months. Right? So I can quit, but I can't get on Thursday. They say one day. Y'all say one day at a time here, right? You new guys say, right? They told you one day at a time. Did they tell you the second line? What they actually mean is one day at a time in a row. They don't fool me with that. My problem is I can quit, but I can't get unthirsty. Now, I might be unthirsty for a couple of days. Feel better, work better, having a better time. That might go on for a couple of 3 weeks. But something's always coming where I'm going to get thirsty again. I own my own business. I'm going to close a big deal, make a lot of money, get thirsty, lose a big deal, lose a lot of money, get thirsty, get a new girlfriend. I'm married, by the way. It's just my story. Get a new girlfriend, get thirsty, get a new boat, get in a convertible, or the big one would hit. Redskins play the Cowboys on Monday night, man. And I'm going to get thirsty. So if I'm going to do this one day at a time in a row, they got to get me the peace I could never find on my own. And that was where I got it, was out of step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening is the result. It is my experience that spiritually awakened alcoholics don't drink beverage alcohol and they don't ever get thirsty. I have been continuously sober since June of 84. I've been continuously unthirsty since sometime in December of 84. I was somewhere in the step work, having had a sponsor for around a month when I had my last urge. If you've been driving around town with a double white knuckle grip on the wheel to keep the car from pulling into the quick stop to get you a six pack, I know what that feels like. But I haven't felt it in 24 years. That's not the package here. But it's necessary for me to dig the poison out. And he was right. I'm going to tell you a rough story. Hard story. Brace yourself. It has a happy ending. In the wee hours of the 4th of July of 1993, my precious daughter fired a pistol into her mouth. I found her. We don't know how much later. We rushed to Vanderbilt Hospital. Within 20 minutes, there's 20, 30 of you in the lobby. By dark, it looked just like this. And they told us for the first 4 days that she would not live. I did not say may. And 4 days is a long time. And I believe if I had not allowed that man to coach me through those 12 steps and had a spiritual awakening as the result, that in that time frame, somewhere in there, I would have committed first-degree murder. I believe I would have done that. And the story wouldn't have the happy ending that it does. My daughter sends you love. She and her husband presented us with a granddaughter 2.5 years ago. She's blind in one eye, has some headaches. And the doctors would tell you they did not do it, and it wasn't possible. You know what happened. May have been people in this room praying for her. I know they were all over the country. I moved into Vanderbilt Hospital. I went home sometime the next day or two and packed a small bag, and I moved into her hospital room, and I lived there for 60 days. Some of you are new, and you don't know yet, and I think you deserve to know who you are, because I know who you are. I know who you are because I saw what you did. I learned that from the Al-Anons. I trust the actions, not the words. Let me tell you what you did. You put a 24-hour watch on me for 60 days. For 60 days, 24 hours a day, there was a member of my home group at least as close to me as I am to Jordan here in this front row. Not to keep me from drinking. They didn't talk about it. It was so that one of my people would be there to hold me at 3 in the morning if I needed to cry. One of my people would be there to hold me. I know who you are. I saw what you did. I had been taught to cry by a member of my home group, a very masculine guy. He's crying at almost every meeting. I'm sober a year. And I go to him. I said, Tony, tell me about the tears. And he says, man, somebody says something beautiful and touches my soul, and I weep, and it feels so good. And I said, I can't cry. And he said, I'll teach you. And he did, as you may have noticed. And I'm very proud of my tears. There may be people now that disrespect me because I'm the guy that cries. I hope not. I hope you like me. Baby, I'm okay if you don't. See, I didn't have that when I got here, because if you didn't like the act, there was nothing, because I thought I was garbage. I was wrong about that. I do hope you like me, but I really am okay if you don't. And if you would like to learn to cry, I typed it up. I am not kidding. I'll have them with me. I teach several thousand AA members and Al-Anon members a year. I'm amazed how many women can't cry. I need to warn you guys, however, there is a warning. Gentlemen, if you start crying at appropriate times and places, you'll attract a lot of very healthy women. Do not call me and complain about this, because I told you right up front that that was going to happen. And if you're married, fellas, don't worry about it. Healthy women don't attack marriages. Ladies, one word, fill in the blank, yes or no. Are you absolutely sick of the John Wayne acts and many of the guys were doing? They see right through it. And they see a guy that's in touch with his emotions that lights them up like pinball machines. And I'm going to change the subject now. My daughter sends you love. I sponsor a guy whose son did not live. And he's sober 23 years now, and I have permission to tell all the stories that I tell. And he said, and you could get up close in his face. They were the lead story on CNN for 3 weeks over the course of the next couple of years. It was one of those deals. And you could get up close in his face and holler at him. You could tell by his eyes he couldn't hear you. It was hard to even get him back into the moment. He's doing great now. He's doing fantastic. He did not drink. This is what he said. He said, one of these days you're going to have to go to the mountain all by yourself. If you have not done the work out of the big book and you don't know how to reach up and take the master's hand, you're not going to be able to go. I believe that. I believe that's coming for everybody. Y'all do much with the 9-step promises around here? We open a lot of meetings with them in Nashville. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. Here's one of the promises I don't think we cover often enough. This is page 14. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. We promise you trials and low spots. That's part of being a human. I hope you get the steps done before the next one. I hope you've got the trash taken out so you've got that empty space to store that pain in. God saved my life. Anyway, I started going to the old Woodbine Club when I got out of treatment, and they had slogans on the wall. One of them said, first things first. I understand that. Of course, I'm a newcomer. I'm not doing it, but I did understand that one. One of them said, let go and let God. I wonder what that means. And one of them said, one day at a time. I already talked about that. But I was only doing one of them. You know which one it was? Oh, think. Oh, man, have I got that covered. My head's on the back. You know, my head's a home entertainment center. Got everything it needs but an off switch. And it is rocking on about 8 stations at the same time. Right? Yeah. I don't find that in the literature, so I've taken it upon myself. You're welcome to this if you can use it. What it says is think. What that means to me is 3 thinks is the limit. Whatever it is, think about it once is good, twice is good, and think about it the third time. After the third think, I must lay it down, for if I were going to outthink it, I would have outthunk it in 3 thinks. If I go to the fourth think, I got a problem with step 1, section B, I'm trying to manage it. The fact is, anything that I'm upset about in my whole life is a 1B problem. Because if I'm upset, I think I ought to be managed. Everything from international politics to the way you drive your car, to the fact that this fabulous woman that I'm married to puts the toilet paper on the roll backwards. It should feed over the top, as I'm sure you all know. She says she puts it on the other way because we've got a cat. I've been watching that cat for years. He does not use it. I guess I won that one, huh? I walked out of a meeting. Amen. I walked out of a meeting one night, and a guy whose sponsor I sponsor stopped me, and he said, "I disagree with something you said. And by the way, if anyone disagrees with anything I have to say, honor me. Tell me. You may have a lesson for me. I don't know today which things I know for sure are wrong. You could have something for me. I don't want to argue with you." And what I had said in the meeting was that my amends to my children would never be complete. And he said, "That's not right." He said, "Did you go to your children and tell them what you thought you'd done wrong? Did you ask how you could repair the damage? Did they tell you? Did you do it? Did you ask for their forgiveness? Did they give it?" I said, "Yes to all of that." He said, "The fact that you're being the best father you can be today is not ninth step work. It's 12th. It's the principles in all your affairs. Spiritually awakened people who have children endeavor to be good parents." Excuse me. "And if you think it's ninth step work, you have not accepted their forgiveness or God's or your own. You have work to do. If your sponsor's got you making living amends, it's okay with me. I can't find that in here. My amends to my children are complete. I'm still trying to be the best dad I can be because I'm spiritually awakened." I hope that helps somebody. It helped me a ton, because I have sure watched teenage and older children manipulate us into some pretty ugly stuff under the banner of, "You were a lousy parent in the past. My amends are complete." And I'm going to tell you, y'all going to have to forgive me, but I'm about medium rare. I have got, would you take this for me? I'm sorry, but I am just baking up here. Thanks. And that helped. What I'm about to talk about can be a hot political topic. Please don't hear that. I'm just sharing my experience, and I got free on something, and I need to share it with you because there may be somebody in a crowd this size. There's about 40 or 50 people that need to get free on this one, and I've been shown how. So if you've done what I'm about to talk about and you're okay with it, I'm okay with it. That's not what we're talking about here. I'm talking about how I got free. I told you about my white light experience and how my soul screamed for forgiveness for the worst thing I'd ever done. As a young man, I paid for an abortion. As far as I'm concerned, I killed one of my own children. That's what it felt like. And if I'd known how that was going to affect me, I'm not sure I would have done it. But that's what I did. And I used to drink it away. I used to have to turn it off. And that's what I'm thinking about laying in that bunk in the treatment center when my soul screamed for forgiveness and got it. Well, I get to the eighth step, and it looks to me like I owe amends to an unborn child, and I didn't know that could be done. And I've been in the hands of Big Book people since I had about 5 months, and I'm so grateful for it. This is page 83. "Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter." And I was shown how to write that letter. And whether it's an unborn child, a grandparent, anybody that's gone to the other side, I can show you how to get free because they showed me. I wasn't kidding. I typed up how I teach people to cry or how I learned on one side and what I've learned about writing that letter on the other side. For those of you who've actually done the four-step out of the Big Book, you know that it's not about writing. That although there's writing involved, it's really the observations and prayers and the forgiveness process in there, none of which are written, that are life-changing. It is my, and if you don't know what I'm talking about, get with someone that does. I have the privilege on occasion of doing workshops on step four. It takes me 2 hours. Paul's got it. But if you've got one of these, do yourself a favor. Pick up one of these things and let me just share my experience. In my experience, this letter, like the four step, is not about writing. It is about tears. And that was for me the cleansing. A couple more kind of pretty personal things. And I say again, if you've done what I talked about and you're okay with it, I'm okay with it. I'm not here to talk about that. But there are people in this room that didn't know they could get free from that. I serve a powerful God, gave me a powerful program. It's more powerful than what they did to me. It's more powerful than what I did. It is that simple. I moved out of the home my first wife and I were living in when I was sober 6 years. She told our daughter this a couple of years ago, that when I got sober, I changed, and she didn't. And I think that's accurate. I am not taking her inventory. I did a tremendous number of things to make her very sick. I am guilty as charged. And what happened to me on my trip through the steps is I got through the steps, I got my innocence back. And she used to control me with my guilt. And I get my innocence back. And I became uncontrollable. And that was very difficult for her. And she was screaming at me one more time. And I got this moment of clarity, and what I realized is I'm just before giving her a straight right to the face. And she's going, I'm 6 feet and 210, and she's 5'5 and 105. And I'm giving her a straight right to the face, and she's going down, and I'm going with her. And she's on the way to the hospital. I am on the way to the jail. This is a bad plan. Worked it out all by myself. And it's a good thing to want anybody else there. And I did an about face with her still screaming. I walked out, got in the car, and drove away. Started looking for an apartment. 48 hours later, I moved. Because I knew if I stayed, it was going to get bad. Because I'd taken all I could take. And I don't know what to do. I didn't believe in divorce. I also knew that if I lived with her, I was going to hit her. I believe today that she wanted me to at some level. Because then she would have had the guilt to control me with. That's their drug of choice. And I didn't know what to do. And I was given a gift, and I just share it in case you can use it. I was given three prayers. I prayed them every morning. The first prayer is, God, if it's your will for us to be together, put us together. The second one, if it's your will for us to be apart, put us apart. Those are the easy ones. Here's the one that counts. God, if it's your will for me not to know today, leave me not knowing. For me, that's step one, section B in prayer form. Jerry said, serenity is not freedom from the storm. Serenity is peace in the midst of the storm. And the only way I can have that is if I give up my need to manage the storm. And the word today is magic in there. That's the magic word. My God is the God of right now. I can't go into the future and expect Him to go with me. He won't go. I have to stay here where He is. And I prayed that prayer, and it was over 2 years before I knew. And then one day I knew. And when after my divorce was final, I asked Ms. Linda out, and ours is a story I hope you get to hear sometime. We frequently ask to speak at conferences together, and I'll tell you what, she's something to hear. Whew, man, I got the brass ring. And we keep our marriage fresh. We keep God in the middle. I was sharing with Vaughn before the meeting. I bought this watch because it has multiple alarms on it. And the second one is always set for the get-up time. The first one is set 10 or 15 minutes before that. And when the first one goes off, Miss Linda and I cuddle. We do our morning prayers in each other's arms. If you can find a better way to start your day, call me collect. I'd like to hear it. Now, I will grant you that there are mornings when that second alarm awakens one or both of us. I'd give you that. Step doesn't say achieve through prayer and meditation. It says sought. And on those mornings, we sought. And that's as good as it gets. And we meditate after, you know, shower and shave and so on. We meet on the sofa. I read 2 pages a day in the basic text. I started it about 23 years ago. I just read 2. I expect that from the men I sponsor. I have some standing requirements. That's one of them. If he can't read 2 pages a day in the big book every day, I probably can't help him anyway. Who are we kidding here? And she reads some Al-Anon literature. We read from some other spiritual literature. It would be inappropriate for me to tell you the name of that standing here. But if you're interested, if you ask me in private, I'm happy to talk about it. We have to leave all that other stuff outside. Because if we cross that line at all, how do we get back? You know, if you can give me the name of some other book of some kind and quote it in an AA meeting, can I quote from Hitler's autobiography? And if not, why not? Where's the line if it isn't period on AA literature? I love what y'all have got written up here for speaker instructions. I endorse that. Anyway, I've got this unbelievable life. But while I was in that limbo period, and I left the ladies completely alone. I was celibate for 3 years. And that's not accurate. I was celibate for a day about 1,300 days in a row. That's a different deal. I guarantee it's different. It's different. And I became comfortable with me. And I don't need to go into. My wife and I are frequently allowed to do a workshop on applying the traditions to relationships. And it takes us 2 hours. I can't scratch that tonight. But we keep that in the center, and it really works for us. During that period, I'm a commissioned salesman, and I had one of those magic days. I walked into my first account, and the receptionist says, he's waiting for you, and I walk into the buyer's office, and he says, here's your order. I haven't got time to talk today. And at noon, my day was done. I got nowhere to go, nothing to do. Fishing gear in the trunk, state park, stream. I'm fishing. Family. Picnic, 7-year-old boy. Looks like he and I are going to fish together today. Looks like I'm going to cast. He's going to do everything else. We caught a couple. And this kid at 7 was a fisherman. I was a fisherman at 7. And he had it. And I met his family. And I was at a place in my life where I had time to do this. And What I'm talking about now is anonymity, and I should have opened by telling you that. I give my last name in AA meetings in keeping with our tradition of anonymity. If that didn't make any sense to you, I'd like to recommend the book Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, page 265, and the pamphlet Understanding Anonymity. We are not a secret society. Dr. Bob said that failure to give my last name in an AA meeting is a break of our tradition of anonymity. We're not a secret society. We need to be able to find each other. You know, you walk in, a member of your home group's in the hospital. You walk up to the receptionist. Pardon me, ma'am. Is Janet from another planet still in 401? Is Chainsaw Mike still? Have y'all still got Chainsaw Mike? So, but the other piece of anonymity that I'm talking about is doing something good for somebody else and not getting caught. And that's an important piece. Because when I do that, I get a gift. And the gift is a little piece of sunshine. It lodges somewhere around my heart. And I can think about what I've done any time of the day or night. And that's what happened here. And so I took this little guy fishing several times and to make sure. And he really had it. And there's a river about an hour west of Nashville called the Buffalo. It's a national scenic river. And he and I launched a canoe. He was eight. And we launched a canoe on that river one day. And we floated 5 miles of river in 10 hours. Caught over 100 fish. It was one of the magic days. And a kid caught a 4-pound smallmouth bass, man. He got my fish is what happened. About a mile from the takeout, the walls of the river are straight up and down. There's nothing. And the sky suddenly blackens. And I hear the thunder. We're going to get it. And I slid over to one side under some trees. And just before the bottom fell out, I'm about to give God a little peace of mind. Did you happen to notice St. Scott down here and the boy and he caught my fish? I'm about to do this prayer. And this beautiful little guy looks over his shoulder at me and he says, is it okay to fish here? It's one of the great lessons in my life. I prayed the third step prayer and I meant it. Prayed the seventh step prayer and I meant it. But I don't remember that all the time. And I think when the skies in my life blacken and I know I'm fixing to get it, I think that's a prayer I'm supposed to take to my Father. Is it okay to fish here? Because that's my assignment. I understand that. That's what I'm supposed to do. Doing something good for somebody else and not getting caught is a spectacular thing. It's a really wild and crazy thing. And I look for ways to do it. I did this one today or yesterday, and Carl has been a great host, and thank you, and thank everyone else that made it possible for me to come. A heads-up penny is a lucky penny. You pick those up, right? What do you do with the tail ones? I've been down and turn them over and leave it for somebody else. And the good parking place in the rainy day, you guys get rain here? On the good parking place close in on the rainy day, I drive by it and leave that for somebody else to find to lift their day. And I take the further out one, and it lifts my day. I thank people for working on the weekend. I will thank all the airline employees that I bounce off of tomorrow. Thank you for working on Sunday. I will thank the hotel people, people in restaurants. Thank you for working on the weekend. Appreciate you being here. I get the gift. One of the standing assignments I have from my sponsor is to spread the joy. It's my assignment. And I look for ways to do that. I found a new one a couple of days ago. If you're near a bus bench, drop your change on the ground. Dropping 50, 60, 70 cents on the ground, I won't miss that. And somebody who's still riding the bus, man, it might change their day. Someone I'll never meet. My assignment is to spread the joy. And what I've discovered is that if I'm sloshing the joy all over you, there's no way to keep it from splattering onto me. It ain't possible to stop it. A fellow named Howard from Gilbert, Arizona. I say y'all have had him here a number of times. Howard's one of my teachers. And he led a retreat for me and the guys I sponsored a couple of years ago. And he told this story, and it's been confirmed to me since then. It's absolutely true. There was a guy who was a skydiver. Did he tell you all the skydiver story? There was a guy who was a skydiver. His great passion was free fall. He loved all the things you can do in free fall. And he was up a particular day, and he had a bunch of novices, and he was checking their equipment, giving final briefing as they approached the drop zone at about 10,000 feet. And they hit some turbulence, and he was thrown out, and he had violated one of the rules, and you know which one it was. And this guy's out at 10 with no chute. And this is a true story. And he is faced with a choice. And his choice is to be terrified of the future, to place blame. They have a bunch of negative emotion and resentment, or to do the thing he loved the most for the rest of his life. And they watched him as he fell. And he tumbled and he dived and he did those things that you can do in free fall. I would propose that all of us in this room fell out of the plane the moment we were born. And we're in free fall. Now, unlike the skydiver, we don't have quite as good an idea of when it's going to be over. But we face the exact same set of choices. To be terrified of the future, to place blame, to have a bunch of negative emotion and resentment, or to do the thing we love the most for the rest of our lives. It was necessary for me to do these 12 steps to dig the poison out of my soul, to begin to find out who I was, so that I could do the things that I love the most the rest of my life. And hanging out with us is one of them. I love us. I love people in recovery. I love the earthlings too, but I think they're boring. My last flight in a high-performance plane, I leveled at 40,000 feet 3.5 minutes after brake release. Yeah, that's what this thing will do. We got to get one. And they gave me a 30-mile circle around a point with some altitude, because if you're going to play at 700 miles an hour, they have to give you some room. And they gave me too much altitude, and I just wondered how high it would go. So I pulled the nose up, rolled in a little bit of bank. I did an instrument climb, staying in the circle. And they regularly told us to stay below 45,000 feet. Above 45,000, there are things that can happen that you don't recover from, that don't happen at lower altitude. And they said if you go above 45, that there were two reasons not to. One is that you would die, and the other is that you would also owe them an airplane. And they were very finicky about their airplanes. But I was young and immortal, and that was in the days before the radar gave them your altitude. They're having to take my word for it, and I'm sure they were making other mistakes at the time too. But I'm young and immortal, and I just wondered how high it would go. Well, the answer is 52,300. That's how high it'll go. I didn't look. I was in an instrument climb. I've not looked out. And when I realized that was all the altitude I could get, I rolled it out on a northerly heading. It just happened to be north, and just looked for the first time. I'm in a bubble canopy. The sun is coming up over my right shoulder. It's about 9:30 in the morning on a clear day. The sky above me is black at 9:30 in the morning on a clear day. I looked out to the west and saw the curvature of the earth. Absolutely saw it. Not a little bit. I saw it. This thing that we're riding is this magnificent blue ball, and it's just floating in space. And I claim it's held there by love. I didn't see anything else. And in the poem High Flight, the author says, I reached out my hand and touched the face of God. Understand that. This is what I did. I had a physical sensation like something warm and viscous had been poured over me and ran slowly down me. I sat there maybe 2 minutes and looked at eternity and was shaken to the depths of my soul beautifully. And I throttled it back very carefully and brought it down, shot one approach and landed. I never told anyone about it. And they would have been unhappy. This one might have done it. I'd been in some other trouble. This one might have been the last one. Anyway, I had been sober for 8 years when I realized that was my first spiritual experience. And I didn't know it until then. Can't do something like that and not want to do it again. For over 30 years, I've wanted to see the curvature of the earth again. And my little old business had a pretty good year in 2004. And me and Miss Linda, we went out to the field in Nashville and hired us a Learjet. Now, they won't let me sit in the front row anymore. I have to sit in the back. But a Lear 31 will go to 51,000 feet. Would you like to know how I know that? I'm going to go again, aren't you? I serve a big God. I've learned to dream big. I hope you have. I'd like to honor that God. I invited him here tonight, and I asked you to, and I believe you did. My heart's been touched tonight. I've cried a couple of times. That's good. If you got touched tonight and you borrowed my God, borrow him again. Something's working. I stand before you in stocking feet. I step out of my shoes because we invited God here. I could have my feet on holy ground. And I try to hold that in heart whenever I talk here. Don was my great teacher. He was the man I used to take the unanswerable questions to. He was one of four that took A to Russia, if you kind of a feel for who this guy was. And I used to take him the questions nobody could answer, and he always answered. And he was always right. When you heard it, you knew it was right. It's always principle-based. We don't do motive here. We do principle. And he was always principle-based. And I spent his last Thanksgiving with him, and we all knew that's what it was. He was terminal. Wasn't any doubt about it. This is his last Thanksgiving. And I had the privilege of spending it with him. And our wives were sitting right here, and they did not see this happen. And across a very small coffee table, I finally asked this gentle giant the question that's been terrifying me for several years. Don, what are guys like Scott going to do when guys like Don are all gone? And this humble giant leaned across and he cupped his hands like this and he said, I have been bringing you hands full of water. Go to the river. And that was the answer. See, it wasn't him. He had gained access to a power and a wisdom vastly beyond his own. And he believed it was available to me. And I believe it's available to everyone in this room. And I'd like to close my portion of this by thanking you very much and by giving you what I think is the single most important thing that's ever been said in an AA meeting. And it's the directions for getting to the river. Here are the steps we took or just suggested as a program of recovery. I love you with all my heart. Thanks so much.